How many film and TV editors can say their very first credit on IMDb is a Christopher Nolan movie? One. Well, probably one. I haven't checked the others, but it's probably one. And he is my guest this week on the Real Feedback podcast. Welcome to episode 102 for my first face-to-face recording, not in front of a live audience since before COVID. My guest is Gareth Hill, who talks extensively about how he came to edit Christopher Nolan's debut film Following, the process itself, working with Nolan, and getting it to the big screen. We also talk comedy editing, for Gareth is a master at it, having helmed the edit suite for all of one of my favourite shows, People Just Do Nothing, and the follow-up movie Big in Japan. We also share our thoughts on Saltburn, as everyone has been banging on about it, The Excellent Peacock, Greg Davis in The Cleaner, being on a panel at the Comedy Festival, I did say he was a master, and more. You can follow the podcast on X and Instagram at Real Feedback Pod, or go to realfeedback.co.uk for the latest and past episode info. Some lovely photos and links of live shows, including Edgar Wright and Brian Blessed, not together, and updates on any other upcoming live shows too. Special thanks to former guest and Wonka editor Mark Everson for putting Gareth and I in touch. This was a really fun chat for me. I hope you enjoy it. This isn't an interview. This is a conversation. This is Real Feedback. Who is it I was reading has no arsehole policy on films? I think it was Brad Pitt.
I read
about last week. Just where if ever he's worked with as a crew member, or I guess it applies to actors as well.
Yeah.
If there's any, you know, DOPs or anything on anyone on set that is deemed an arsehole in his eyes, no, they're not allowed on this next film, even if, you know, yeah, it's me or them, and he won't do it.
No. I've sort of the no dickhead rule. I've heard it called that. You know,
sounds like the British version.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the no dickhead rule. Yeah, just don't be a dick, yeah, basically. Yeah. Same kind of thing.
Well, we mentioned before we started recording Mark Everson, who I have to say hi and thank you to, for passing your number to me, because ex-guest of Real Feedback, and who I stay in touch with, because as we said, he's a really lovely guy.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy.
So hi, Mark, and because I know he goes, oh, you got to speak to Gareth because I want to hear it.
It's been a privilege to get to know him in the last 12 months, because I was likewise, I got asked to do a panel for the BBC Comedy Festival. And I was thinking, and I was like, oh, I'd love to hear like what Mark's got to say about editing comedy. Mm. So that's how a friend of a friend, you know, found his email address and linked us up. And yeah, he's a lovely guy and like ridiculously knowledgeable, and his work's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Paddington 2, you know, Wonka. Those stuff. Yeah. And all the stuff before that, Peep Show, The Boosh, all of that stuff.
Well, because I spoke to him, I was at Working Title, and I had two, it's the only time I've done two in one day.
Oh, okay.
And I spoke to this producer, and then Mark was afterwards. So I went down and met him. The producer, he's a lovely guy, but he wasn't very serious, but it was, you know, there weren't that many laughs within the podcast, but that's fine. That's not what the podcast is about. And then there was Mark, who was this kind of breath of fresh air, you know.
Oh, yeah, he's so warm. Like I say, so warm, so knowledgeable. He's a lovely guy.
So you said about the comedy festival. Is that just... Can you explain a bit about what that is? Because obviously there was a panel for editors. Is it all behind the scenes people talking about roles?
It's a big mix, because they started doing it when COVID finished. So they did one up in Newcastle, and then last year's one was in Cardiff. Next one's going to be up in Glasgow in the springtime in May. And basically, it's called a comedy festival, and it's part festival, part trade fair. Trade fair is rubbish. That's a rubbish way to describe it. But and then there's a lot of students there as well. So they based it out of the university up in Newcastle, the university in Cardiff. So the guests at the last one, I mean, the lineup was ridiculous. Rob Brydon was there. Jesse Armstrong was there. Sharon Horgan, Jamie Dimitru, just kind of everybody was there. The previous, so there's those kind of guys, and then there's, directors, Ashitala, producers, people there sort of talking about the nitty gritty of how you finance films. But like Jesse Armstrong sat and talked for an hour about Succession and how that came about. So there's that side to it. Mm. And then there's what we were invited to do was talk about, you know, editing comedy and what is it you do to try and make things funnier.
Is there such thing as a
comedy editor, and then if there are you putting yourself into a certain, that you're pigeonholing yourself?
There's sort of I suppose there are, I mean, within editing, there are definitely people like to try and sort of keep you in a lane, because it's easier for producers to sort of understand, like, oh, he, you know, they're a documentary editor. Oh, they do comedy, they do drama, they do reality TV or whatever, and I've been lucky that I've been able to sort of switch lanes and sort of do a couple of different genres over the years. But there's definitely, yeah, I suppose that is a thing that people will look at your CV and go, oh, you know, does this person have, you know, comedy chops? You know, do they know how to sniff out the jokes and stuff?
So when you're actually doing a narrative and you've got a script anyway that have the jokes in the script that you then need to cut into the show.
Yeah.
Is the comedy editor, is the role to find the funniest take and where to, because sometimes a joke is where the cut is.
Yeah.
You know, you leave it hanging too long, it's not as funny. But if you, you know, depending on what you cut to, that makes it funny. Is that what makes a comedy editor?
Because you're basically trying to heighten it as much as you can. So you're trying to, the way we described it for the panel was making funny people funnier. So you're trying to take the work of funny writers, funny performers, funny directors, and then dial it up and put it on the edge of how funny it, you know, it can be. And part of that method is that, you know, the first method you use is to sort of squeeze the air out of something, you know, to make the dialogue as quick as possible. So if you watch Succession, like the dialogue in that is like machine gun out. It's rapid fire all the way through. So that's like a sort of first comedy method, is to make the dialogue as fast as possible and then work out where you're going to put a pause. You wouldn't, your drama would tend to have more pauses. You know, if you've got one pause in a scene in a comedy, that's probably enough. So you'd work out where that is.
And that might be putting a pause in by switching to a reaction shot.
Yep.
That could be from an earlier part of dialogue.
But a reaction
you
shot.
Create the joke almost.
And a reaction shot is another method that if somebody says something ridiculous, you'll then put a reaction shot in of somebody noticing that.
Yeah.
So it's that thing that happens in real life. If you're sat around the dinner table and somebody says something stupid, if you catch the eye of somebody else, it suddenly becomes funnier.
Yeah.
So that there's those kind of methods that you're using to just try and heighten stuff all the time. And then there's other stuff that you'll suddenly maybe work out as you're cutting a scene that, oh, actually, hang on a minute, this will be funnier if we hold this information back to the end. If we, you know, it's a comedy reveal. You know, if we reveal that this person, you know, has forgotten their car keys, reveal that at the end, that becomes funnier. That they've been lying all the way through the scene, and then you reveal at the end what they've done.
Do you find that if, say, you did 6 weeks on a comedy show and you went straight into a drama, do you struggle to adapt? I mean, is there anything you can take from getting a joke to getting a dramatic moment? Does it apply?
Yeah, I suppose you're always still looking for tension and release. That you're sort of looking for those things, but I suppose it depends what your sensibilities are. Like whenever I've cut documentaries, I've always thought, and it doesn't matter how weighty the subject is, you know, it could be about somebody who's suffering with cancer or, you know, something like that. In real life, funny things will still happen. You know, something will get spilt, something will, you know, so in order for it to feel true, you still need to keep those moments of sort of levity in there. So I sort of always feel that comedy is never, you know, never too far away, even in the sort of bleakest of circumstances. But yeah, you're right. Sometimes you do have to sort of recalibrate your head a little bit. Mm. And certainly I think whenever I start on jobs, I sort of realize that sometimes you can overcut stuff. The first stuff that comes in, you're slightly trying to work out what, you know, where the funny is, what is this? So then your tendency is then to sort of overcut everything and try and put everything in. And then once you're a few days into the project, you'll realize you'll go back and watch the first stuff you cut and you think, oh, I've done it again. You know, I've still, even though I know it's an elephant trap, I've still done it.
Well, because people could get fatigued watching it. There's so much being thrown at them.
Yeah, it's so- or you just realise, oh, actually, like I didn't need to do that. That person's, that actor is doing everything that, that they need to do. I don't know, need to chop it up.
Yeah.
You know, just sit on it. And actually, and then sometimes, you know, editing is not cutting.
Yes.
You know, it's leaving it. Yeah, yeah. Leaving it to hang and leaving the performer to do what they're brilliant at.
It's interesting that you said that Jesse Armstrong was at a comedy festival and he spoke for an hour on Succession, when I thought you were going to say Peep Show, but Succession is hilarious.
Yeah, well, it's brilliant, but he acknowledges that the roots of it are in comedy. Mm. And then when you look at it and the like I say, the dialogue is fired out, and you look at those boardroom meetings, some of the things that happen, you know, they're pure, that the essence of them is the DNA of it comes from comedy.
Yeah. Well, I would, changing subject, I would put money on the fact that you are the only editor on IMDb whose first credit is a Christopher Nolan movie. Well, obviously I knew you'd done Following, is what the film we're going to talk about, Christopher Nolan's first film. So I thought, okay, let's see, you know, where you started out. Oh no, that's his first credit on there. I mean, it might not be your first credit because IMDb is sometimes not quite true to fact.
IMDb hadn't quite got, when I did that film, it had just really got going.
Okay.
So I don't think there's much on IMDb before that.
And I wouldn't have changed it anyway. I leave it as Christopher Nolan as my opener.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this is a story you've told a million times, but I know this was on your website. I purposely didn't read it.
Oh, okay.
Because I want to hear it fresh.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't want to know what you were going to say. How did it come about?
It's like the classic sort of sliding doors moment, really, where I'd got a job. I was in my early 20s and I'd got a job at Framestore as an assistant editor. And so I was working in Soho, and there was a guy there called Ivan who sort of looked after the sort of IT network. And on a Monday he came in with a DAT tape and, a beta roll of film transfer. And he was like, oh, can you show me how to sync this sound up to these pictures? And I was like, look, leave it on the side, because it will take me longer to show you than it will for me to just square it away and do it. So leave it and I'll sort it for you, you know, before I go home. Did that, gave the tapes back to Ivan. 2 weeks later, he was back with another couple. And I was like, fine, you know, leave it, I'll sort it. And then, so that went on over a period of weeks. And then his friend, Chris, was calling in to pick the tapes up, to sort of watch through them. So Chris would come in and we'd sort of, I'd play through the takes and we'd just sort of watch stuff together. And over the weeks, we sort of got to know each other a little bit. And then at that point, I was an assistant. I really wanted a project to get stuck into, to sort of move on with. And I said to Chris, oh, like, how are you going to finish the film? And he was like, well, we haven't got any money. You know, I think he had a couple hundred quid and he'd booked an old tape suite, a U-matic tape suite, these big old clunky tapes that no one wanted anymore because everyone wanted to work on Avid, the new digital technology.
Is that what you were working on, Avid?
Yeah, Framestore kind of had all the latest digital kit. So I said to Chris, look, I've got the run of this place at the weekend. I'll be allowed to come in at the weekend. Let's come in. Let's make the film. And he was like, yeah, we haven't got any money. Let's do it. So that was the moment where he said, yeah. So the weeks went past and they carried on, finished shooting, because they were all studying and had full-time jobs and stuff. So they'd just shoot every other weekend. And then Chris did like a rough, he did the first assembly on the tape suite and then came in and then we took it on and we worked weekends through the summer of 97. All the way through that summer, we worked every weekend and some late nights and stuff like that. And that's how we got it made.
I mean, what's amazing about it is that, I mean, obviously it's his first film, so it's going to be very different to his films now. But knowing how much he champions IMAX cameras and stuff like that, is that it's shot in 4:3.
Yeah,
and looks like, I don't even know if he's used any actual lighting other than what was in the scene at the time, because there's a lot of natural light being used and it's very dark.
No, you're right. You're right.
It's 4:3, and I don't know if it's shot on 16mm or what.
He had. I think they borrowed cameras from his old university film society, But what he did was, the genius of it was that he had devised the film to fit the resources that he had. So he knew that black and white stock was cheaper than colour stock. The processing was cheaper. So that was a way to sort of save money.
So it wasn't an artistic decision. It was almost...
Well, it was taking those resources that he had and then forming the project around that. So it never looked like a compromise.
Right.
So the fabric of the film is made from the resources that he had. So yes, you're right. He knew he couldn't carry like a full lighting rig around. So a lot of the time the characters are sat next to windows and so on. And there's, you know, lots of shadow, but then that genre of film noir lends itself to those kind of slightly gloomier lit things. So again, he wrote a film that he knew he could achieve without it looking compromised. Mm. So the weapons in the film, he didn't write, you know, a big shootout with guns in the film, because he knew he wouldn't. If he tried to do that, it would end up looking really ropey and fake. So the sort of violence and the weapons in the film, like one of the main weapons, a hammer. So it's like, so that looks true and it looks real. So that was the genius of it, was not writing a car chase, not writing a big shootout or anything like that. It was all contained in a way that it would still feel true and achievable with the locations he knew he could get access to. So it would never look like a compromise.
The thing that I found amazing was I read that it was shot, like you said, weekends and that, over the course of around a year.
Mm.
And I wondered if you found, when going through the rushes, if there was any, because, I mean, as a first film, you don't necessarily have a script supervisor.
No, it's just being Chris.
When he was shooting, to ensure that, well, hang on, this scene is played after the last one that we filmed 4 months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
There was nothing watching it, and you went, whoa, you know, his hair's now, whatever. Was it? Did you find any?
No, Chris was
hurdles.
I mean, Chris was sort of pretty meticulous with that, and there was the big moment when Jeremy cuts his hair in the film. That was all carefully planned to make sure have we got everything that we need before he cuts his hair, because he went from having sort of long shaggy hair to, you know, really short hair. So there was no turning back from that point. But no, credit to Chris and Emma that they'd planned everything so meticulously that those things didn't happen. But it was a skeleton crew, you know, like you say. I mean, he again planned it so that he knew that on any given weekend they could all get in the back of a black cab. So the amount of kit they had would always fold up into the back of a black taxi. Yeah. So if they had two locations that they could do it, all of them could get in one taxi and get across town with the two lights, the camera. And so it was all kind of meticulously planned. Like I say, so you wouldn't watch it and go, this feels compromised. It all feels like a whole, it feels like a whole unified thing, but that's because Chris had, you know, thought it through that meticulously.
But when it came to the rushes, because of his budget restrictions and things like that, did you have a sort of a wealth of takes to choose from, or was it,
no,
you know, we've got two takes, this one he didn't.
I mean, sometimes not even that, they'd rehearsed it and rehearsed it and rehearsed it again so that they could keep the cost of you know, film stock down and the film processing down, so that when they turned the camera, it was almost like theatre actors, that they knew the script inside out because they'd rehearsed it and rehearsed it and rehearsed it, and then they'd turn up, rehearse it, and then go. So if there were three takes of something, that would be...
I've got a choice.
That would be, you know, that would be extraordinary.
Wow.
Because it was thought through so efficiently, you know.
I did like that when they left the second flat they burgled, there's a Batman logo on the door.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's been
pointed out. Yeah, no, it has been, but which was a sort of weird coincidence that sort of foreshadowed, you know, what came next. But the remarkable thing about the film is when you go back to it, yes, it's shot on a shoestring and stuff. You know, his films have gone on to look obviously way more spectacular. But the DNA of a Chris Nolan film is all there. the blueprint is all there. The idea that there's three narrative strands that are intercut in a non-linear way, that's all kind of there. It's the most obvious. In these other films, the method becomes way more complex, but it's so easy and clear to see in that film, the three timelines. And even then, in his first film, the dialogue is written in a way that it rewards a second viewing. So that if you've watched it the first time and you get to the end and you know the outcome and who did what to who, when you go back and watch it again, then the dialogue between Cobb and Jeremy, you re-listen to it and you think, oh, and there's a duplicity, there's a duality to it. Yeah. So even in his very first film, he was writing in such a way that a second viewing would be rewarded with additional meaning, which all his subsequent films have gone.
Were you picking up on the editing and going, that's just bloody clever? I mean, obviously at the time it's a guy that no one's ever heard of and all that. So, you know, did you realise he was going to be big? I'm not even going to go to that because it's a ridiculous question, but could you see stuff in there that you just thought, this is a really interesting...
I suppose we were just kind of doing it in a weird way, and not analysing it too much. Chris was, I mean, right up until the last, I can remember the last day that we were editing, because his wife, Emma, or his partner then, had a job and she was going to be going out to America and he was planning to go with her. So there was a bit of a timeline ticking on when we were going to try and get stuff finished by. Up until that last day when we were editing, Chris came in on that Sunday morning. We'd worked on the Saturday, came in on the Sunday and he was like, right, I've got it. We're going to move scene, this one scene to here, that scene to here. That will mean he knows this, she doesn't know that. So at the last minute, we were still moving the scenes around. But I didn't have the, you know, I was sort of running more on instinct because it was Chris that knew the structure of the film inside out. I mean, he rarely came, I don't really remember him coming in with notes, because quite often you'd go into a cutting room, less so now because everyone has iPads, but there'd be paper all over the place in cutting rooms, you know, of just like stuff that's been drafted and chucked away and scripts all over the place. But yeah, he was never like that. He kind of always held it all in his head. Not that he was being secretive, but it was just he didn't need to write it down. He could just hold it all there, and he knew the script so well that he could sort of see, if he moved the puzzle pieces around, what the impact of that would be.
Because there's even, you're talking about signature Nolan stuff earlier on, even the soundtrack, there's that sort of ticking clock score that goes on, that rhythmic.
Yeah, exactly, which just brings that urgency that's there right from the outset. And David Julian, that did the music for that, he's really interesting because the score's actually on Following is really stripped back. It's quite minimal. And I know when David was doing it, he started to pile more instrumentation in to make it bigger, but somehow it didn't fit because the film is simplistic in its nature that it didn't warrant a big wall of sound. And actually he sort of then stripped it back to being a more minimal soundtrack, like you say, with kind of slightly brooding strings and that sort of scratchy ticking that just does that thing of putting you slightly on edge and gives it that sort of weird urgency that it needs.
And it's only 70 minutes. Was that, did you say, well, I'm aiming for 90 minutes, or is it just, it's as long as it is when it's right?
Well, no, what it was, again, this is how sort of well thought through it was that he'd realised that at the time, to qualify as a feature-length film, you needed to be 70 minutes plus if you were going to enter film festivals. So he'd made a number of short films, but he didn't want to make any more short films because then you're one of a much bigger pool of short films because, you know, lots of people make 10-minute shorts. So he wanted to make a feature as a way of, separating himself out a little bit to push things on creatively, but also to sort of separate yourself out to sort of so that you'd be able to go into the bigger film festivals.
Wow. So we and it only just does. I mean,
yeah. So, so
69 minutes. Can we get some more of that guy walking?
Well, yeah. There was. if you look at the first versions, there's some shameless padding of the logo, of logos and end credits to sort of make sure you meet the 70-minute 70-minute threshold.
But oh, is all the credits included in a running time?
Yeah. Well, that, the way we were counting it, definitely. So when I finished working on it, we'd taken it to the point where I'd mixed the sound in the Avid. It's just like a, you know, the best mix we could do with what we had, the tools that we had. And Chris was leaving for America. So I sent him off with a Digibeta copy, which, you know, just the big old chunky tape format, and some VHSs to take with him to show to people. And off he went. And then he managed to get it into, I think it was Toronto Film Festival. And he phoned me back up and said, oh, we've got it in Toronto. I've told them we've got a print. I haven't. We've got 10 days to get the print sorted because they've put it in the program and it's on. It was like, oh, fuck. Just like, and like the anxiety. It was like, of course you're going to do it.
Yeah, you can't go that far.
No. But the anxiety was like, Chris was out. And so I was sitting there and I just went through all of the edit logs, all of the EDLs just meticulously. It was like, if they're going to cut this neck and I've called it wrong and mislabeled some roles or whatever, oh, I'm just there. So it was just like, that's kind of anxiety where you
just... And he finds out at the festival.
Yeah, at the festival. I think he borrowed... £1,000 or whatever off a family member to get the print made for the processing and stuff like that. Jeremy, we got the print. I went and checked it at one of the labs. Jeremy was going out for the screening. He took the print with him on the plane. And the first time Chris, Emma and all of them saw the print was as they pressed play at the
festival.
So they were all sort of equally sort of like, anxious, like that knot, that horrible knot of anxiety.
It's probably good it was only 70 minutes then, because you'd have to endure 2 hours of wondering.
But after it got into that festival, it then, you know, the other festivals were like, oh, okay, you know, we'll take a look at this. And then it got momentum and it won a cup. It didn't win for, it won like, you know, the audience award at a festival or a, you know, newcomer type award. So it started getting some notoriety. Then it came back. One of the prizes was some completion money to mix the sound properly. Then it came back to the UK and sort of did the round at European film festivals and stuff like that. And by then, Chris had the idea for Memento was bubbling around. And I think the story is that at one of the festivals in Hong Kong or something like that, you know, he was like, if you like this film, you know, I've got another one up my sleeve, which is, which is the next level one, which was Memento.
Did you expect a call for that? Or were you?
Not really. I mean, I was incredibly lucky to have met Chris. When he got the chance to do that, again, I think it was either Ivan or David Julian, the musician. I was chatting to them. And I said, you know, Chris has been having meetings with Brad Pitt about his next film. And it was like, wow, you know, he's sort of gone from us a friendship group making a film. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, like he's suddenly sort of in that category. And I think with the knowledge that you have from being in the industry a while, you realise that if studios taking a risk on an essentially a rookie, you know, a first time director or a new director with this slightly bonkers script where everything's back to front in Memento. Then what they then do is put sort of certain key people in key positions, you know, like a DOP and stuff. And I think David Julian did the music on that. But again, it was, you know, there was sort of various conditions, you know, that if the studio didn't like his second draft or whatever, they had release clauses built in and all this kind of stuff. But I'm pretty sure David's music was on the film. So no, you sort of understand how that structure works to sort of, you know, make sure that stuff happens. But yeah, certainly don't resent it. There was a really nice, to give you an idea of the type of guy he is, by the time Following had come back and it had done the rounds at a couple of European film festivals, it was out on DVD, you know, it didn't need to generate a lot of money to pay itself back if it made for peanuts. Yeah. Anyway, I was at Framestall one day and this box arrived, a big nice box from Fortnum and Masons. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, it had my name on it, and opened it, and inside was a really nice posh bottle of champagne with a check for $1,500 sellotaped to it. And so Chris had sort of, you know, sent that over. So that's, you know, he didn't owe me anything. You know, he genuinely didn't. But that's the kind of, you know, person he is and Emma is, you know, that they sort of recognise the effort that went in, you know.
So, do you watch his films now? And are you able to watch stuff? I think I've asked every editor I've had on this. Are you able to watch stuff impartially without going, oh, I wouldn't have done that, or that's interesting?
I know, I think you do. I think you do if they're good. Which it is like, because I really like going to the cinema. We've got a little cinema up the road called the Lexi, which is brilliant. And I love going there, and the people there are lovely. And I think going to the cinema, you will put your phone down and stuff. Whereas if you watch a movie at home, you are more inclined to check your phone and, you know, things like that. I think the only time you find yourself like, you know, picking holes in something is if it hasn't captured your... if it hasn't captured your head for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But when a film captures your head, you know, I'm all in as far as I'm, you know, I'm in for the ride, you know, or whatever it is, you know, the thriller or the story or I'm all in. So yeah, I don't feel the need to do that. I think it's when you're not in it, then you start thinking, I'm not sure about the music or, you know, or whatever. But no, so I enjoy going to see its films.
Do you have to, going back to your comedy, if you're working on a comedy show, do you find you have to, if you get a chance to go to the cinema, you're like, I'm not going to see a comedy. You're not bothered about what you watch, or do you need to sort of balance it up by seeing a horror or a thriller or a drama? Or you just go and see whatever you fancy?
I go and see whatever I fancy. And I really try not to watch trailers or read reviews beforehand, you know, because I want to try and go in cold and watch a film. So I went to see, I'm going to see The Holdovers on Thursday, which I'm really keen to go and see.
It's amazing.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, so I'm not saying
about anything. It's really good.
So I've not watched any trailers. I haven't read any reviews. Like, loads of people like yourself have said, it's good. And that's all I need. I'm in. And I think I went to see Anatomy of a Fall in the cinema up the road. And because I'd been working from home, I was like, oh, I've just got to get out of the house, you know, have a change of scene. And I went and watched that, and I didn't know anything about it, and then was just sort of drawn into that film as well. So yeah, I don't sort of feel the need to just watch comedy. Mm. I mean, I suppose sometimes you watch stuff on the telly, you feel like, oh, I need to watch this almost as like homework.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
You know, which is a bit...
What are the other guys doing?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. but yeah, certainly, I like going to the cinema. When the lights go down, I'm in, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not good at not watching trailers and reading reviews.
Oh, okay.
But I did manage to watch Saltburn last week. Purposely staying away from knowing anything about it.
Yeah.
I just kept seeing stuff come up on TikTok and things going, my face when I watched it, my parents, you know, and like, wow, what's happening? Yeah. What is it? It looks immaculate. The performances are incredible, and it's edited very well.
Yeah.
And it's shot beautifully, but it didn't really do it.
No, I agree. I think it's beautifully crafted.
You've seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah. And there's lots of love about it. And then, yeah, I love that reveal in the middle with the, where he, oh, well, I don't want to spoil it for other people.
Well, just it's forward 30 seconds. Go on.
Yeah, the scene in the middle where he gets taken back to his parents' house. I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
That was such a good reveal. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
So, I enjoyed it, you know, but it didn't capture my head like Anatomy of a Fall did.
That's because all the Oscar noms came out today. Was it yesterday? And that's in...
Yeah, that's...
the film? But I mean, there's a clear run of Oppenheimer, obviously, but there's a lot of the same Maestro, Poor Things.
Yeah.
All, you know, you get years like that where they certain films dominate all the big categories.
Yeah.
Holdovers is in there.
And then the other film I went to see in the last few months was How to Have Sex, which is like a British film, new director, new performers. which isn't as smutty as it sounds, the film. But that's brilliant. I'd recommend that if anyone hasn't seen that, just right. like some really brilliant performances yeah. in that. You know, and again, it's somebody's first debut feature, and you think, wow, if that's your debut, and you know, a lot of the performers are like first time performers, it's like, wow, those guys have got bright futures.
Because mm. you know? So, obviously, I've mentioned the editing I do isn't like what you guys do, but I know what goes into putting, even though I said that about Saltburn, it just wasn't for me. I don't like bad mouthing words. Yeah. I know no one goes in trying to make a bad film TV show. But when it all just comes together,
yeah,
and works, it's pretty amazing to see, because you just think there's so many cogs and elements that have to make this work,
yeah,
as flawlessly as it is.
I think the out of Chris's films, the film people are always trying to rank his, you know, his films in, yeah. in order, like Mark Kermode does it and tries to rank them, and they have arguments about it and stuff like that. But the one for me, when I went to see Batman Begins, the first Batman film, like I my jaw was properly on the floor, because I was like, how has he done this? He's gone from making his self-financing his own film, you know, with us, to making Memento, and then he made Insomnia, and then suddenly he's making like this huge Hollywood film in so few steps. He's making this film, and he's and somehow he's sort of also reinventing the genre of superhero films.
Yep.
And I was like, how has he done that? How it's so hard to make films, so hard to sort of even make television programs, to convince people to gamble on something and do something different. And I was like, somehow he's reinvented that genre of superhero movies, because the Marvel films weren't really big.
No, it was before Dark Knight was before Iron Man.
Yeah.
That was 2008, wasn't it?
So it kind year, of maybe. Preempted all of those, and then created the space for all those films to be made. And then the Bond films kind of got realer after that as well, because in that Batman film, you know, he gets bruised and he's fallible and, yeah. you know, all of those kind of things. And then suddenly, you know, all these other films started to sort of allow their heroes to be, you know, to show weaknesses and yeah. be fallible and all yeah. those kind of things. I was like, I generally, like, I know other people prefer his other films, but that was the moment where you sort of go, oh, wow. You know, he's somehow has taken, he's a young-ish director, and he's managed to convince that studio to spend on him, and he's sort of bent it to his will and has somehow reinvented that genre.
Yeah.
So I was just...
And they've also probably gone, and when we do the big CGI bit, No.
Yeah, yeah. So
I
somehow...
I want to do as practical as I can.
Somehow he swam against all of those kind of instincts that studios would have had to sort of draw him in. Mm. And he was true to his vision, and he made a brilliant film. You know,
I remember going to see Dunkirk in IMAX, and the opening scene, I thought, I'm going to have to leave. It's and I've seen Metallica live. It was the loudest thing.
Oh, were you at the one in Waterloo?
No. Oh, okay. This was it was my local one. So it's an IMAX, but it's not the IMAX.
Yeah,
so
sure.
And it was so loud.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, I've been a musician for 30 years. I've heard it all. I've stood next to snare drums countless times. And I had to sit there with my fingers in my ears. And then the bit in the boat, when they hide in the boat.
The gunshots
and you
off.
Don't know when the gunshots are coming. And so it was like I was watching a horror film. I had to put my fingers in my ears because it was making me literally jump out of my seat.
Yeah.
But the time thing there was just like, what? That's so brilliant.
I know. It shouldn't work, should it? That there's one story's playing out over a week, one over an hour, one over a day, one over an hour.
Yeah.
And yet somehow... you stay with it and you follow it and you don't question it, you know, because it's woven together so well.
Well, I'm going to flip this completely on its head and talk about Corrupt FM.
Keep it corrupt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we get into People Just Do Nothing, we'll talk about what you're working on currently, which is this, because it features a lot of the same people, is Peacock, the second season.
Yeah.
So season one was only 3 episodes. So it's, if I get his name wrong, correct me, and then I'm going to do it again. Is it Alan Mustafa?
Yeah, but he goes by the name Sieper. Everyone calls him Sieper, okay. Which was like an old...
Because sometimes it's in the middle, isn't
Alan
it?
Alan Sieper Mustafa, yeah. Right, so okay. That's like, it was like a, I can't remember if it was a graffiti name or something like that. Yeah, anyway, that's his nickname.
All right. Yeah. So, yes. So it's Alan Sieper.
Yeah.
Mustafa. So yeah. Oh, eyesight is terrible. Yeah. And Steve Stamp.
Yes.
And so this obviously came after People Just Do Nothing, but I just thought because it's what you're working on now, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, so that is their new show. So we're on series two. We're doing six episodes this time. The central character, he's a personal trainer, and he's kind of a man out of time, basically. You know, he's in his late 30s, but thinks he's still in his late 20s. His mates are settling down, having families and stuff, but he thinks he can still go out on a Monday and get smashed. He's a man out of his depth who's just kind of anxious about getting older and stuff. So, but those guys, they're very funny. They're just sort of naturally very funny together because they've known each other for years. Mm. You know, that is the essence of People Just Do Nothing, is you're watching a pretend friendship on the screen, but in reality, they are all friends. Mm. So the gap between what's happening on the screen and real life isn't sort of that big. It's not like they've cast actors to fit together. Yeah. It genuinely is a group of friends, which I'm sure, you know, you've got a group of friends and each person within that friendship group somehow performs a different function.
Yes.
You know, what somebody's the organized one, yeah. Somebody's, you know, the one who's always late, someone's the rec head, someone's the, you know, and that's their friendship group, and that's what is to me the sort of essence of People Just Do Nothing.
I've read that whilst watching it, because I started watching the series when it, I didn't see it when it first came out. My brother-in-law recommended it to me, I don't know, 3 years ago or something, and I watched it. I was like, oh, fucking, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
And then sort of read up on it and read that they about their background. And I don't know if that kind of, I don't know if I'd have felt that I, because you can feel it on the screen. They must know each other. It's too, yeah. I thought, but I know that. So I don't know if that's informing, you know, but it does, for me, they definitely had a different vibe on the screen, I feel, than if they were just cast and met each other on that job.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. And there's something like they've, you know, if you get invited to go along with a group of close friends, it's like you've been invited. I think watching the show, it's like you've been invited into their friendship, you know, and you can draw up a bar stool and you can just sit on the, you know, and you're sitting on the edge of it and you're watching this friendship dynamic. And you sort of recognize that friendship dynamic. You know, people often said to me, oh, I knew that group of lads when I was at college or at school, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, you know, arguably, you know, you might have probably been in them, you know, in that group of lads, but you didn't realise you were, So you were either in that group of lads or you recognised them from your local town or your local college or whatever. So there's just a familiarity to it. And when they're together, because there is a script, but because they know each other so well, they can sort of go off it quite effortlessly in a way that quite often, if you put a group of comics together, they'll try and outdo each other and we'll sort of compete to get the last bit in. But the way they are together is that they're not trying to do that. They're just trying to give the joke more wind. So if you can see that Asim, who plays your buddies, got an idea, then they'll just be sort of feeding that idea with, you know, extra stuff. You know, you know, it's that in the same way that, you know, you'll have stories within your family or your friends where someone left their luggage somewhere, and you know that story gets retold and retold and retold and embellished, and you don't tread on it. You're just trying to give it an extra. And it's that I watch it and you think, oh, that's. And that comes out of their friendship of knowing each other for such a long time and trusting each other, that they're not competing. They're just genuinely trying to make it funny and trying to make each other laugh. They're always trying to do that.
So when you've got rushes that, you know, there's the scripted version and then there's other, I mean, so for the edit, do they get you to sit and assemble it on your own and then they'll come in and tweak? Or because if you've got, okay, there's the script, but now I've got this version where they improv that and I've got this version where they did that.
Yeah.
I think this is the funniest bit. I'll put that in. They might not agree. How does it work when they're working in that manner?
Well, each scene that they'd do, there wasn't like a set method. So some scenes they'd they'd sort of hit the beats of the script and it wouldn't deviate that much. Other stuff would just go completely off. So I'd you know, watch through the rushes. I'd get the first bite at it because, you know, let's say they filmed on a Monday, I'm trying to edit those rushes on a Tuesday. By the end of Tuesday, I need to have tried and got a rough cut of all of Monday's rushes. And then you keep going like that through the shoot. So you're always trying to keep up with the shoot. So you're not trying to make the perfect version because that's impossible in the time allowed, but you're trying to give a like the best version you can of that scene. And what would often happen is you'd look at the script and go, oh, okay, there's a good version of the script. But while they're performing it, you can see, oh, actually, Jack, the director, spotted something in there. And he said, you know, go on, keep doing that thing, like when you were DJing, keep doing that thing about, oh, I don't know, the giving out the rate, giving out the number or something, give that shout out again. And then they'd follow that. So then the scene as they're performing it would evolve. So there's the scripted scene, and then there's this other version, which they've tried to capture in the moment. And then sometimes I'd look at it and go, oh, hang on a minute. Actually, if I took that bit from the eighth take and that bit from the first one, there might be a third version of this as well. Okay. So sometimes I'd sort of put like the scripted one together and go, look, there's the scripted one, but I think you guys got something better in that one or that one. Mm. So I'd have the sort of first bite at it, and then Jack would come in, director, and we'd watch through everything. We'd watch through the assembly edits, which were always way too long because there was so much funny stuff. And then a bit further in, once Jack's had a pass at it, Steve would come in, and the other guys would sort of feed in through Steve, and then we'd work out how much of this extra stuff can we load back in. Each episode, some of the episodes, the first cut would be like, you know, 70 minutes long.
Oh my God.
Which for a half hour, scripted half hour,
yeah,
is like that, like the script supervisor would ring me up sometimes and go, oh, can you give me the timings for this week of how, you know, so I can tell whether we're on track.
Like, yeah.
Well, you know, I can if you want, but they're not going to be any use. So we'd sort of collapse it down. And they'd come down to like about 35 minutes. And then we'd sort of, this weird thing would start to happen where as you were compressing it, like the tempo and the cadence of the jokes and everything would just sort of steadily increase. And then we'd work out, you know, Steve would remember, oh, you know, Asim did something funny in one take. Can we weave that in? So you weave that element in and then another element. And then, oh yeah, Hugo did something where he gave side eyes to somebody. You know, let's get that in as well. And then suddenly the tempo of it would just sort of go up and up and up and up. And then suddenly it would sort of come to life as it got closer to 30 minutes. And it would get this weird sort of giddy momentum. So because quite often in People Just Do Nothing, there aren't sort of typical jokes with setups and punchlines, and there's not really sort of big set piece, you know, slapstick moments where people smash through a wall or fall over or, you know, stuff like that. The momentum of the show almost becomes part of the comedy. So whenever you sort of come to put a trailer together for it, or people would pop in and say, show me a bit. And I'd play them something. And I think on its own, this bit isn't as funny. But when you watch the episode as a whole, it gets such momentum that incidental stuff like Hugo giving somebody side eyes DJ Beats suddenly becomes like a big release. So I sort of realized over time that in the same way that there's a flow to it. And when the shows hit that sort of tempo and that flow, then they would take flight in the way that, you know, like the obvious example with rappers, like the lyrics are important, but the cadence of it and the flow is also almost as important, the delivery of it. And that's what would happen with those shows, that as they got tighter and tighter, the tempo would go up and the cadence would go up and it would just really start to fly.
I mean, so you're saying about the watching one bit, I rewatched a few episodes this week because I think I finished it, obviously, apart from the film. I finished it maybe 2 years ago, two and a half years ago. But the final episode when Mish leaves the salon, it keeps going back to her trying to find out about her surprise party. which is clearly from the outset is not happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the payoff, the final thing when they're saying goodbye and she realizes, oh,
this is it.
A bunch of flowers and the pen.
Yeah.
And then she leaves. But that one is like, any part of that on its own, like you say, it's not just a gag. We keep going back to it, but there is a payoff, her walking out the door and then the rest just kind of left standing in the shop.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But I mean, the thing that I watched the film again this week as well. So I watched the film when it came out. But it's just, I wanted to talk about how historically British comedy migrating to cinema is for the most part a failure.
Yeah,
was that on your mind? I mean, we're talking like on the buses. But it, you know, Ali G and whatever, it doesn't translate. Was that a fear for you?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, when we were doing the fourth and the fifth series, we were like, it'd be amazing, wouldn't it? If we got a chance, it'd be amazing, wouldn't it? I mean, there was no talk of it being a film, but you just think it would be amazing, wouldn't it?
That was one of my questions was, did you know at the end of season 5 there was going to be a film?
No.
So they thought that was goodbye.
Yeah, we that was it. Series 5 was done and that was the end. So it closes out, as it's a complete thing by the end of series 5. So there wasn't, there was like a sort of desire amongst us, but it was, I don't know, it was never really much more than pub talk. When the chance came along, one of the things in my mind was like, just don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
Do this. Yeah. But then over time you think, well, if Steven Seeper bring their A game, Asim brings his A game, Hugo, Jack, you know, if I bring my A game, if we could all bring our A game, then there's a chance, you know, we won't mess this up. It's like having a chance to go to a cup final. You know, it's like, you know, if you're all fully fit and on your A game, you know, you could win, an FA Cup final. So it was clear in my head. It was like, you know, a cup final like Everest or whatever. It's, you know, it's a chance to do something quite big. But just, you know, like, do not mess it up. But I think that when I sort of rationalize it, you think, okay, no, if we all bring it, then there's, it's going to sound arrogant, but you think you'd back yourself not to fuck it up.
Yeah.
But you realize that, there's plenty of shallow graves in Soho Square of directors and projects and, you know, and editors that where it hasn't worked out. So
did you have a moment of, this is working?
Yeah, it all happened through lockdown. So it was broken up by that. So the chance to shoot it came along. I think the head of Focus Features at the time was a fan of the series. And the head of BBC Films, Rose, she was a fan. And that was the sort of genesis of it, as I understand, to get the thing up, you know, right, let's do this. So they went out to Japan in the autumn of 2019 to shoot. So they shot out there for like 4 weeks or something like that. Then came back to the UK, did another couple of weeks shooting in studios here. And then, you know, so we were working at Molinaire, one of the post houses in town. And then by Christmas 2019, COVID was knocking on the door and was starting to come, you know, to the West. By the middle of February, we were sort of getting closer to a date where we'd have to, you know, deliver. And we were doing test screenings and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, well, the world stopped.
Yeah.
But I look back at that now and think, crikey, we were lucky. Because, you know, if they'd been due to shoot 6 weeks later, I don't know if they'd have been allowed into Japan. Because that part of the world had already started to, you know, restrict movement and shut down. Mm. And then you think, if COVID had come and gone, would the appetite still have been there to, you know, to do the film?
Yeah.
So like, I think we were incredibly lucky with that. And then, so we were working away at Molinaire. We've got all this huge amount of improvised material to work through and sort of to the ability to completely rework scenes and just make completely different scenes out of stuff. So we went into lockdown middle of Feb 2020. Yeah, we finished work on a Friday afternoon, put all the kit in a taxi, and I was back in the loft here on the Monday morning, and we were all working remotely. And what that did for us was, like, the whole world had stopped, and suddenly it bought us time. And we sort of benefited from it in a weird way, because the release date had just sort of been kicked out the window.
Yeah.
And nobody had anything else. No, there were no other productions up and running. So it bought us time to just go back and just make sure we'd chiseled out every single moment from the rushes to feel confident that it was as good as it was, as it could be. But yeah, definitely feeling like it was going to work, because you go through all these test screenings, that you do one big test screening at the end, big market research screening called the NRG, the National Research Group, where they do a big test screening to like two theaters of 200 people or whatever. I mean, it's a small film. The big films, they test endlessly. And then the information from that, they aggregate it all down to like one number. Who said good, who said excellent, all of this stuff gets aggregated down to one number. And if that number, I can't remember what the threshold is, but let's say it's 80. You know, if it's over 80, then the studio would back the film, spend money marketing it, and it would get a theatrical release. If you're below that threshold, that's it. We're not spending any more money on this. So you're sort of sitting there in the theatre watching it, and people are laughing. You think, keep laughing over there.
Back laughing louder. Yeah.
Go on, keep it going. Yeah, really good that bit. So they do that, and unfortunately, but at the end of that night, we sort of sat and listened through the focus group, and we were comfortably above the threshold.
Yeah.
And they decided to hold on to the film, thinking that when cinemas reopened, they wanted a feel-good, happy film to be able to put out in British cinemas, not because everyone was sort of fed up with relentlessly sort of bleak news stories and so on.
Yeah.
And at that point you think, oh, brilliant, they're going to hang on to it. We're going to get a chance to go to the cinema and watch it. And we'll have our moment in the sun. And then it wasn't until that summer it was the summer of 21, when I was out in the street and I saw a bus go past with the poster on, and I was like, oh my God.
Oh.
Like they actually are, they are spending money on this.
Yeah.
And then these big posters started appearing everywhere. I was like, oh my God.
Well, then, is there a picture on your website with you, your son at the cinema?
Yeah, I took him to see a film as a treat in the school summer holidays, and they had like a massive poster saying coming soon. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
They were good to their word, and they hung on to it and backed it. And yeah, then it went out in the cinemas. And look, we were never going to rival the Bond film in terms of numbers or anything like that. But I think that first weekend, there was like a massive Disney film called Free Guy out. So he was at number one. People Just Do Nothing was at number two, and I was like, yes, I'll take being second. Yeah, to yeah. Like
I'll lose to Ryan Reynolds.
To like a huge Disney film.
Yeah.
So over that first couple of weekends, it did all right, did its thing, and it's nice for you to say that it the conversion did work, because it feels like it did. And if we've I was a massive fan of Spinal Tap as a teenager. I still love it. It was on the other night. I've recorded it to watch it with my son, because he hasn't seen it. And it's like, I'm comparing it myself to Spinal Tap, which is like, we're barely, because I love that film. I like that. That's a real sort of luxury to sort of even put them in the same sentence. But it's like, if we could have made something that people love as much as I love Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
You think, oh, that's kind of like the prize. That was always the prize, I thought. You know, if there's a generation of grime fans now who are 17, 18, who look at that film and it does what Spinal Tap did to my head about, comedy. Well,
we need a new champion.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many. The thing that I found was there's one particular part I want to speak about in a minute, which for me was, I was so impressed. It was such a genius move. and I want to know how it came about and whose idea it was. You're thinking, yeah. What bit's he talking about?
Yeah.
But I just wanted to quickly touch on the performances in it and the different characters. That they're just flawless. And like you say, you've got this, that one is that person, that one's ever.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel false. Or we need a dopey one, and we need an aggregate. But Asim, particularly the scene where he's at the table with the Japanese guys having dinner, and then he gets the bill. Yeah. just the way he does a runner. I mean, it's just. And the thing is that Grindr is he. If he was a successful grime artist,
yeah.
You would hate him because he's such an asshole. Yeah. And even to his best friend. And for me, only really, it's only in the very end when Beats comes out and the trousers come down. and you really get the sense of how much he loves it. And that bit on the rooftop before that. And he puts his arm around him. You go, he does love him. You know? And there are obviously smatterings of that throughout. But generally, he's just a real, and even to Mish. But the bit in, I want to talk about, and this is, if people haven't seen it, stop this now and go and watch it, or skip 5 minutes, is the end scene where you're using the guys in a karaoke booth about to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Oh, yeah.
Well, twofold, actually. So, that yeah, and then it's Grindr coming back after they've all fallen out. And the bit as they hug is where the song lifts. I thought that's genius. How do you get that sort of cheesy moment? They're never going to, you wouldn't use that as a soundtrack, but you use them in that situation for karaoke. So that was brilliant. But the other thing that was brilliant was when they then decided to, they find a Corrupt FM track on the karaoke and it cuts to the crowd cheering on the bad boys.
Oh, back at the concert. Yeah.
But it's edited like, you know, when they finish, you've got the crowd cheering. They're never going to have their moment on the stage in front of 10,000 people ever. But it's formulated in such a way that it feels like they've had their moment. They didn't need it. They just needed each other in that room.
Yeah.
But it has for the audience who wants the big moment. You get the cheering of the crowd. It's so clever, that bit. I was just like,
yeah, no, I'm. That's brilliant that it came across in that way, because you sort of can never quite tell how audiences connect with it, but it was always scripted as they go back and bond in the karaoke room in this small time, you know, tiny little karaoke room, but it was director Jack who wanted to make it a back and forth between the big concert, the big glitzy concert, and then in the karaoke booth. And it took ages to get the balance right of seeing enough of each side to know that the baddies have got their comeuppance and the good guys are back together and having a brilliant time. We did version after version after version after version of just recalibrating it and seeing a bit more on this side, seeing a bit more on that. Oh, now they're too triumphant. They shouldn't, you know, and then just trying to find those moments of in the big concert where it felt believably bad because it couldn't look too rubbish. So it had to look believably bad in the big concert that Tacker had got his comeuppance and the guys still needed to, you know, look, have that effervescence of like being back together to carry that end moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, we did version after version after version, but it's brilliant. Jack will be over the moon. That's the way you perceived it.
Yeah.
Because that was always...
It was such a smart move because I think if, you know... Many other films would have had the big moment where they end up on the stage together.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and it would have been great, probably, whatever. But it was quite not a bold move, that's a bit too over the top. But just that they, after all this, they still don't get their huge fame moment. But they're happy.
Yeah.
Because Grindr could have had it with the giant head people on the stage, but he didn't want that. He wanted to be with his mates.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally, that's what, for me, people just know nothing about is a group of mates, and they're only happiest when they're together.
I completely agree. And I think that's what I was saying to you earlier, is that you're watching both a real friendship of those guys play out and a fictional friendship play out. And it's exactly that realization that,
yeah,
yeah, you know, off, you know, after fame and fortune, it you come back to your family and friends, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, and that's where the heart of it is. And I think in Peacock as well, that similarly comes, you know, it, the essence of that, the heart of it is still back with a friendship group that are tight and look out for each other and make mistakes and do stupid things, but ultimately always gravitate, you know, back to each other.
I loved how in Peacock, because it starts off, you think he's this, you know, Casanova at the table, and then slowly, you know, he takes her home, and then you, his mum, goes, "Is that you?" And you're like, oh, okay. He goes, but I've got a completely separate flat. He appears to have stuck his own mailbox outside his room to make it seem like a different flat. But I mean, it was weird. First of all, it was weird hearing him talking not like Grindr.
Okay, yeah.
I've only ever heard him do that. But how, when he does get someone who wants to be with him, and then, but then he nearly ruins that because of his...
Oh, well, you'll like series two.
Okay. Yeah. It's like he finally tries to do something at the end, and, you know, he knocks on Steve Stamp's door.
Yeah.
And I'll do it for free. I want a year. No, 6 months. So, you know, and it's like... And I, you, because at first he's a prat, isn't he? He's, and you kind of feel for him because it's all going wrong.
Yeah.
But he's not really helping himself. But then when he starts to, he does start, even if it's only three episodes, so it's like a film length if you watch them all. He does, by the end of it, start to, you clearly can see he's trying to turn it around. And nearly ruins it with this gig. Oh, see, I'm giving it away now, but we should watch that as well. When, okay, to wrap then, because I've got to get to this gig. When is, because you're in the thick of the edit now.
We've got 4 weeks left. So we've delivered, we've finished four episodes. We've got 4 weeks left, so 2 weeks to close out the other two episodes.
Right.
So I'm on it for another month. And then I don't know when it's out. It'll all be mastered and sound mixed and stuff by the spring, by Easter time. As an editor, once you've done something, you just want it up and out as quickly as possible. You don't, because there'll be music in it that you've chosen, you know, there'll be jokes in it and stuff like that. And the worry is that the longer something sits on the shelf, or somebody else will use that piece of music, and you're like, no, we did it first. Yeah. You know, we did it first, not you. You know, we weren't copying you. You want your stuff to go, you know, once it's done, you want it up and out, and you want, you know, you want people to enjoy it, and you want, it's that thing of, you want it to connect to people, right?
You know,
it's like you're in bands, you know, you perform, you want that sort of connection of people seeing it or enjoying it or listening to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not there to just sit on a server somewhere. You want people to be able to sort of engage with it.
Well, you said about you don't want to leave it too long. We had a wedding. We played a wedding on Saturday.
Yeah.
And because we were 5 minutes late on the stage, there was a singer singing to backing tracks to the crowd while we were setting up.
Yeah.
And they went one more song, and they looked at us. Are you ready? We're like, so one more song. She then plays our first song.
Yeah. It's like, no! Phone. Yeah.
Out of all the songs you could have chosen. Oh. So yeah, I get what you're saying. I just want to quickly mention two other programs you worked on. So I watched the first episode of There She Goes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And again, I went in blind. I just saw David Tennant, Jessica Hines. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. They're amazing.
That's powerful. That. And there's tonal shifts in that as well. Yeah. And I read up a bit about it afterwards that I don't know if it was the director or the writer kind of based it on his own experience.
It's Sean Pye, the writer. Yeah. It's basically, it's his life. You know, his daughter was born with a chromosomal disorder that nobody knew what it was. So, you know, she had quite profound special needs.
Mm.
So, but he's a comedy writer, and he's written all kinds of stuff. But it was his way of articulating that. And it is, you know, it will make you laugh and make you cry. There's no doubt about it. But the episode I worked on, the joke ratios, like there's like three jokes on a page. But because the material does have emotional weight, you sometimes don't always register just how fast and frequent the jokes are, you know, the jokes are coming in that.
I didn't realise you didn't work on the series, so I've probably watched the wrong episode.
No. I was incredibly lucky. They made two series. My friends Mike Holliday, Bridge Williams and Mark Henson did the series. And then they did an hour-long special to close the story out. which is the one I did, which went out just before Christmas.
Oh, okay, well, I mean,
I was standing on the shoulders of giants with that one. Right. Yeah, you know, I really was lucky.
Well, I was sold by episode one, so I will get to your episode because I am going to watch it. It got me straight away. But the other one is The Cleaner.
Oh, okay.
Because I'd seen that anyway, and I love Greg Davis and any series that has Helena Bonham Carter having a shit in the first episode.
Greg Davis. Like I think I'd watch him doing the washing up because it'd be funny.
Yeah.
You know, you'd watch him doing the hoovering, it'd be funny. He's like an open fire. You just sort of warm your hands on him because he's just such good company, and he's got a brilliant sense of the absurd. You know, that kind of comedy that like people like Bob Mortimer do, where they can just say ridiculous things and do ridiculous stuff. Yeah. And it makes sense because it's Greg Davis doing it. You know, so
I'm going to jump.
Yeah, I know. It's just like he's such a nice guy. He comes into the edit occasionally, but he's such a nice guy. He really is. And he's absolutely massive, you know.
Yeah.
But he's a top guy. He really is a lovely guy.
Yeah, he's on my list of my wish list.
Yeah,
it's Greg Davis.
Oh right, yeah, no, yeah. Oh, he'd be a fantastic guest.
Yeah,
but like we're massive fans of Taskmaster in this house. Mm. It's such a good show. Like it's the one thing that all four of us like will like. You know, it's an appointment. If somebody watches ahead, you have to be given permission to watch ahead. You know, because we've all promised. Yeah. There's like a pact.
Well, I remember when I was looking up for ideas of. Comedy guests to try and poach, and I thought I'll just look on Wikipedia who's been on, because I think I'd only seen six or seven series of Taskmaster at that point, and I started looking through, and then I realised that it highlights who won each season. I was like, oh, I can't look. So I thought I can't go into a new series going, well, she wins.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had to turn that off. But I love Taskmaster, and he just rips the piss out of all of them. They love it.
Yeah,
he just doesn't care.
No, it's amazing.
And little Alex Horn.
Yeah, so, they're so funny.
Yeah,
such a good show.
Gareth, I look forward to Peacock season 2.
Oh, you'll enjoy it. Yeah, you've picked up the threads that fly in series 2.
Right, good.
So you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. But thank you so much for...
Oh, man, it's been a privilege. It really has.
Like, I mean, the thing that had me... I was interested anyway, anyone, Mark, because he got me Nigel Williams as well. But when I just thought, what a great contrast of Christopher Nolan's first film.
Yeah, yeah.
And people just do nothing. Obviously, there's other stuff as well. But those two things, there's such a contrast.
Yeah, I've been lucky that, you know, I've had, like I say, a couple of those sliding doors moments. Where you know you meet good people and get on with them, and it comes together, and then you know there's no way in a million years, like 25 years ago when Following first came out, that you'd think people would still be talking about it 25 years later.
Yeah,
no way at all. You know, so when they re-released it on DVD last summer as a 25 year anniversary thing, as a big box set thing, and I asked me to do an interview. I introduced them to Jeremy, and then they got Chris and Emma and David, the musician, and they made it into like, and Chris has had the Neg remastered by one of the picture houses, and the Batman team remixed the sound and stuff.
Oh,
and
right.
they've put it out as like a big limited edition box set. Yeah. It's like, wow, that's insane. That like, there's no way in the world you'd say that 25 years later, people would still be like coming back to it.
You know, I hope they sent you a copy.
Yeah, yeah, no, they did. Yeah. But yeah, it's incredible. You know, that from that moment, you know, time's passed and people keep returning to see it. You know, so really lucky.
Well, thank you, Gareth. That was amazing. Thanks for having me around your house.
Yeah, pleasure, man. Mm-hmm.